Well, good morning. I'm David, and I'm part of the Justice and Service Commission. You know, when I came to PMC oh so long ago in year 2000, it was called the Mission Commission. And these, in my work with Bread for the World, I end up connecting with a lot of such committees and commissions. Mission, justice, peacemaking, service. And those, in a sense, are just words. But in another sense, those words are laden with important intention. And so let me speak a little bit to that intention. A few years ago, I was invited to join the leadership team. And so I got to join these wise, experienced people who were guiding the church. And so I was kind of quiet, a little bit shy and timid at first. And different people had different concerns or priorities. But I finally found one thing that I got wound up about, to the great amusement of the rest of the leadership team. And that was this name, calling it, I remember a lot of amusement, Justice and Service, as opposed to Service and Justice or something and something, because I thought it was aspirational, that we want to try to live in to justice, that we do seek to do justice, as we hear in Micah. Or I'm just going to reread from Luke 4, to preach good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, to liberate the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. I love Luke 4. And our former senior pastor, Pastor Tim, would fondly, humorously, but I think also seriously, often refer to Luke as, do you remember? The best gospel. And I fell in line with that. I've come to consider Luke the best gospel as well. And Steve and I can argue later. But anyway. There is an important intention at PMC. I mean, when I first came to this church, the very first service that we heard, the founding pastor, or at least our first pastor, who was one of the co-founders, Jim Brenneman, was quoting Che Guevara, Chairman Mao, and others about building community in cells, and was also calling for kind of radical revolution in our world. And that day at service, PMC called for volunteers in civil disobedience. And from there, we saw many occasions of PMC standing alongside hotel workers who were striking, or other people who were speaking out for their rights and their hopes. So there's been a long tradition of that. So I think that we are, in my opinion, well-named right now, even if they are, again, just words, the Justice and Service Commission, that God willing, we can step forward into areas of justice and be called there. So today we have a panel, rather than me speaking, we'll have Bert and Katerina speak a little bit and share about specific ministries that are really prominent with the Justice and Service Commission. So, Katerina, why don't you begin with the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery, and if you want to talk about reparations or other issues, and then Bert will speak about making housing and community happen, and then we'll come back with a follow-up question.
Thank you, David. So we were asked to speak about ministries that we're involved with and that connect with the church and the work of PMC as well, and this is just two out of many that the church is engaged in. So this will give you a sneak peek, and hopefully in future services we can hear from others as well. The one that connects most with what Celeste was sharing about, and that I worked with for 2 years as a staff person and for about 4 or 5 years as a volunteer and continue as a volunteer, is the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery, of which Pasadena Mennonite Church is a member of the repair network that the coalition started, and that was my role as an organizer to help launch back in 2019 or 2020 or so. David asked me before, as I was preparing for the panel, you know, how did I get started in this work? And I wanted to start with a positive story, because it's really easy to start with all of the injustices in the world that we see. But what really launched me was when I was a student in college at Wheaton. Some of you went to Wheaton College as well. I got to participate in the Human Needs and Global Resources program that sends students out for 6 months to live with communities in the Global South and to come as learners and students. I was placed in a rural village in northern Luzon in the Philippines called Imugan. And back in the 1970s, the people there and the elders had won some land rights struggles against the Marcos regime that was trying to grab their land for a golf course, it turns out, and develop it. But they had won what became known as the ancestral domain. And it was a kind of land claim, a land rights struggle that spread in different parts of Southeast Asia to recognize that there are peoples who have domain, who have sovereignty over land that their ancestors have lived on for generations, for many, many generations. And it was the first time I had been in a community that had their own forms of decision-making, of elders' council, of governance, of self-determination, meaning they could make their own decisions about what happened in their communities as a people together, and had the rights to decide what happened on their land. And you could see the boundaries of the ancestral domain because it was forested. And the land around it, it was deforested, and a lot of illegal loggers and others had come in. So you could literally see the difference between indigenous sovereignty and harms where people don't have their land rights and land is clear cut and people don't have access to clean water. But I lived in a community where people still spoke their native language, and I tried as best I could in 6 months to learn some of that. They maintained, my host father was a forest guard, meaning he went out there and planted trees in the forest, replanted, and then selectively thinned trees, and made sure illegal loggers weren't encroaching on their lands. And the cloud forest there was just really key habitat, and a lot of their work was to preserve the watershed so that they maintained clean water for everyone living downstream. And that was a sense of love for their neighbors who lived downstream from them as well. My host mom, who was a school teacher and also a farmer, said that, you know, we're poor, but we always have food. And she took me out to their Inuman, their farm, to teach me how they grew food. And when I think of statistics, like I've heard that 80% of Earth's biodiversity is tended by indigenous peoples who live on less than 5% of Earth's lands. That was an example to me of seeing that in practice. And that to me is why it's so important for us as Christians and those of us who are white settlers, especially who have benefited from injustices against indigenous peoples, to support their efforts, because people who live in a place for thousands of years develop practices and knowledge and wisdom and skills of how to tend that place, how to protect, how to preserve. And it's embedded in language and culture and so much more, the relations with that place and with one another and with land and territory. So I wanted to start with that story as what got me involved. During seminary, I was introduced to the Coalition to Dismantle the Doctrine of Discovery, and it's a mouthful. It requires some defining. The Doctrine of Discovery I hadn't heard of until maybe 2014 or 2015. It's really the name for the legal framework of European powers who took control over indigenous lands that they quote-unquote discovered. And it's a collection of papal bulls or documents that record the Pope's pronouncements, royal charters, and other documents that form the basis of international law governing land title today, which basically means that in the 1400s and 1500s, if you were the first European power to a place, there had to be some legal framework to adjudicate who got that land, whether it was the Portuguese, Spanish, and then later English, French, and so on. And to me, it's the antithesis of the good news, because it was a Christian framework. It is a Christian framework, so-called Christian framework. And the first power to basically plant a cross on that land got the claim to that territory. It was the gospel as territorial domination, gospel as expansion of land in the name of God and King of these European powers. And those structures don't just go away, but they continue today and are embedded in legal decisions as recently as 2005 by the Supreme Court deciding about land in New York, whether it should go to the Oneida Nation, or to the government or the state, I believe, is just one example of how that continues in Western governments. So it's both a legal framework, but I think there's also a spirituality to it and a way of viewing land through a framework of domination and control over resources that went and benefited those who were descended from European powers, Christian, so-called Christian nations, and part of it was a mission by conquest of converting by claiming everyone in that territory to be subject or subjugated to that European Christian power. It's the reason why today, for example, the U.S. government could take public lands in Arizona and decide to swap them and give them to a multinational copper mining company, even though those lands are a sacred site for Apache people since time immemorial at Oak Flat, where some of us went in the fall. It's the reason why lands don't belong to indigenous peoples so much of the time who have ancestral connections to them in Western governments, that their prior land claim didn't mean anything. And so they're fighting for that in the court at this time. So the doctrine of discovery continues to this day, forming the basis of land title. The governments that then inherited those lands from the Christian powers, like the U.S., inherited the quote-unquote rights of discovery from the English, the French, the Spanish, and continue to defend those land claims over and against indigenous peoples who often live in poverty, struggling to survive, fighting for their rights and land claims. And so our coalition to dismantle the doctrine of discovery organizes the church to say, we have some responsibility to bear in this. And it's really calling Christians through a process of repentance and repair to use that responsibility for good alongside indigenous peoples in their struggles for justice, in their struggles for right relationships with land, with creator, with one another, recognizing the ways that, especially for those of us who are white settlers, that we've benefited, and that churches and the Christian church as a whole has been a part of this gospel of conquest in the name of Jesus. So we have the responsibility and the opportunity today to seek repair. I wanted to share some examples of groups that we're partnering with. One is Apache Stronghold, which is about to take their case to the Supreme Court after hearing it locally at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in Pasadena. Twice it's been heard at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it's been overturned both times, not in favor of the Apache, but in favor of the U.S. government, to preserve their land from destruction by a multinational copper mining company, Resolution Copper. So our coalition has accompanied them for many years, especially Tucson Mennonite Church has been very involved in that. Our coalition was founded and organized by Mennonites, but is open to other groups as well, and really seeks to partner with, not to come in and say we know all the answers of what you should do, but to seek their strategies and to bring people alongside in their strategies for justice. Another group that we've worked with, we mentioned the Mayan community, who are seeking to practice agroecology, to save their seeds, to protect their land and water. And it turns out one of the main groups that they are seeking to form neighbor relations with in the face of government strategies to push them off their land are the Mennonites, who are often engaged in industrial farming practices in that region. German-speaking, old colony Mennonites, Low German Mennonites they're called, who moved there from northern Mexico and live in pretty closed off, fairly isolated communities where they speak German. And the Maya people are seeking to draw connections with their neighbors for the sake of the protection of land. Another group that we've partnered with is Makoche Kichupe, which means Dakota Land Recovery. And the Dakota peoples are seeking to restore their homelands, of which they occupy just 1% of their historic homelands in Minnesota, especially. And there was a hopeful story, actually, of a community that's part of the repair network raising funds so that a Mennonite family retiring from farming could give their land back, their farm back, to Makoche Ikichupe, to Dakota people, seeking to create a village of healing there, where they're going to be restoring the land. It was farmed in a really healthy way, and so there was a celebration that happened when that land was returned and restored to Makoche Kichupe, and decommodified, in a sense, returned to the original stewards of that place. And they're part of now are the Mennonites in Minnesota, and who are part of the repair network of the coalition, are part of a larger campaign to insert reparations into their state budget so that some amount of real estate sales, a percentage of that, would go to Dakota peoples to be able to buy back their original homelands. So there are many other campaigns that we've been involved with, and we work in different committees. Volunteers can join, and then we also have a repair network, which our congregation is a part of. And we invite people to educational work, to solidarity actions, to put reparations in the budget, which we have at Pasadena Mennonite Church, 1% towards Indigenous groups seeking their own strategies towards justice, and 1% towards Black groups who are also seeking reparation for similar structural evils of the sins of white settler colonization and white supremacy affecting both groups as well. And finally, the other point in our repair network commitments is that we connect the work of repair with climate justice, that it always goes back to the earth and with care for creation as well. So I see that as deeply part of our work at PMC, as many of us are involved in and concerned about climate change. These aren't separate issues, that the stewards of the land were forcibly removed from their homelands oftentimes, and we're seeking restoration of land, water, for the sake not only of Indigenous peoples, but all life as interconnected. So I'll pause there and pass the mic to Bert to share a little bit about making housing and community happen.
So this is a lot. I know you guys are gonna get in a lot all at once. So my name is Bert, by the way, for those who don't know me. It's like Sesame Street Bert. And there are other kinds of Berts, but I'm Sesame Street Bert. And I'm going to talk about our Ministry of Housing and Justice, and I'm also going to start, I was asked to talk about how I got into it. I came to Pasadena in 1991, and I realized that's really a long time ago. Somebody told me recently I was an adult, but they were born in 1993. I was talking to them about when I came. Yeah, so that's a long time ago. But I came here, I was living in South Georgia, and I came here for Fuller Seminary. But some of us in South Georgia, where I was, first of all, I was part of this generational cohort of young evangelicals who were sort of called to something called urban ministry. I don't even know if that's a thing anymore, but back in the 80s or 90s, urban ministry was really hot. And in South Georgia, some of us were reading a book by John Perkins. Do any of you know who John Perkins is? Who knows who John Perkins is? Well, that's good. So that's great. I don't hear people talk about him a lot anymore. But he wrote a book called And Justice for All, and he encouraged, I think, mostly middle-class Christians, probably mostly white Christians, too. He himself was African-American. He had been involved in the civil rights movement in Mississippi and then moved to Pasadena. But he encouraged Christians to center their discipleship around what he called the three R's. Do you all remember the three R's? If anybody read this, remember his book? The three R's were reconciliation, which I think a large part of it was racial reconciliation, but other types of reconciliation as well. Redistribution of wealth, and relocation. So back then, we were being encouraged to move into lower income areas. And so that's what I did when I got to Pasadena. And coincidentally, this is where John Perkins lived. So he had moved here into Northwest Pasadena and started the Harambee Center. And the Sharps know all about the Harambee Center. Where are the Sharps? So I moved around the corner from the Harambee Center, and I joined a church that met there, an African-American church met at the Harambee Center. And so I was part of that. My wife and I were part of that for a couple of years. That's actually where Gloria and I got married. And so I was looking around Northwest Pasadena, and I was thinking, man, this place is going to get gentrified. I could tell, because I was surprised it hadn't happened already, because in other parts of the country, it had already started happening in the 80s. And in 1991, Northwest Pasadena still had gentrification, still hadn't hit there, but there was a lot of this old stock housing, and I knew the real estate people were probably going to look at that pretty soon. And sure enough, late 90s, gentrification hit. And so I was trying to figure out what to do about it, and I read in the Pasadena Weekly about this group of people that was organizing to address the housing crisis. So I know there's a there's a big housing crisis today, but even back then in the late 90s, we were having a housing crisis and gentrification. But there was a group of people meeting at the American Friends Service Committee. For those of you who don't know, the American Friends Service Committee is a Quaker organization. And back in those days, their Southern California office was here in Pasadena. It's now down in LA, but back in those days, it was in Pasadena. And so I went and joined in with them. And when I joined with them, they didn't have a name, but we've decided our name would be Affordable Housing Action. And our first campaign that I got involved in was the Inclusionary Housing Campaign. So inclusionary housing is when developers, when they build a housing development of a certain size, they have to set aside a certain percentage of the housing as affordable. And there's a formula for it. So we did that campaign, and we won it. We got an affordable housing ordinance passed here in Pasadena in 2001. Later, in a much later campaign in 2019, we updated it. But from that one ordinance, we have over 1,200 units of affordable housing here in Pasadena from that one ordinance. So our group kind of waxed and waned over the years. We went through different names. We were Affordable Housing Action. Then we were the Pasadena Affordable Housing Group. Then we were the Greater Pasadena Affordable Housing Group. And then in 2018, two of the people involved, Anthony Manusis and Jill Shook, formed a nonprofit called Making Housing and Community Happen. It was a nonprofit formed so that we could raise money and hire staff. And so it's Making Housing and Community Happen, or MHCH. And it was named that way, I think, so that people would have a hard time remembering the name. So at least I'm convinced that's what happened. I was not part of that naming. So, and I didn't want to call it MHCH, too, for the letters. I wanted to call it MHATCH. I thought that would work better, but I got voted down. So, but we're MHCH, or Making Housing and Community Happen. And so we got this nonprofit. We started hiring staff. We first hired an admin person. And then in 2019, I abruptly left my full-time job with no plan, and the organization hired me. I was the first organizer. So I'm now, it's part-time. I'm paid part-time, but I tell people, you know, it's part-time, but it's 24/7 a lot of the time. So, and since then, we've been able to get a lot more done. We've had a slew of victories. One of the victories we've had, you can go look at right now, it's on the corner of Orange Grove and Fair Oaks. That's going to be, it's just opened 69 units of permanent supportive housing for unhoused seniors. So seniors, yeah. Seniors that have been living on the streets or in shelters, and seniors are the fastest growing part of our homeless population because they're on fixed incomes, and when housing prices rise, they're the first ones to hit they sometimes become homeless. And so they're unhoused seniors right now that are moving in. They're right now moving into this beautiful new building on the corner of Orange Grove and Fair Oaks. And that was actually the last campaign I was involved in as a volunteer, before I was staff. We started with a prayer meeting at the site. Some of us slept over at the site to bring attention to it. There were unhoused seniors sleeping there, and so we slept with them. Then we gathered petition signatures from the neighborhood to show that the neighborhood wanted this, because that's usually one of the things that happens is the neighborhood pushes back. But we gathered petition signatures. We did an email campaign. We got people to come down to city council. We packed out city council. We won that thing at 11 o'clock at night at a city council meeting. So it was after hours of testimony. And those of you who were at the recent city council meeting where we got a resolution for a ceasefire in Palestine, you know how long that can take. It was like that. It was, hours and hours of testimony, and then you win late at night. And that's some of our best victories have been like that. So anyway, that's where we are. But is there a follow-up question?
Well, I mentioned that this commission is aspirational in name and nature. And in one way that it's aspirational is that, in all truth and humility, we mess up, we make mistakes, we know that, and we, God willing, learn from those things. And as a commission and as a congregation and community, seek to to do better. But at the same time, I think justice in a larger sense is aspirational, that we seek to help grow the world into that place. So with that, briefly, what are your next steps and what do you hope for in these areas of ministry?
Well, maybe one way to tie them together, one thing that I'd love to see is a conversation with the Justice and Service Commissioner, ongoing conversation. It just started here at PMC about how are these different justice efforts connected. So here, Bert's talking about affordable housing, and I'm talking about people getting pushed off their land. How do we view land? How do we view private property? How do we view ownership of resources? And how do we seed a new vision as PMC? The Jubilee vision that we heard in Luke today, Jesus saying, I came to bring, you know, release to the captives, sight for the blind, freedom for the oppressed, the year of the Lord's favor, which he refers to as the Jubilee year, the year of redistribution, of leveling, the 7x7 Sabbath year. That gives me hope and energy to dream what could Jubilee look like here in Pasadena, around the world. How can our small congregation be a place of foment, of yeastiness, of dreaming, of prophetic imagination for what Jubilee could look like in our time and world? Because we're desperate for it. These issues impacting Indigenous peoples are also impacting us, and I think there's good news when we connect with land and one another and place in liberated ways. There may be new ways of seeing and being and relating that address the spiritual impoverishment of our, like Celeste was saying, feeling isolated, feeling lonely, feeling realizing that maybe this economic system isn't really working for any of us. We're struggling with affordable housing. You know, many of us here in this congregation are struggling. And so I think Indigenous peoples and other oppressed groups have been the canary in the coal mine, but ultimately it's impacting all of us. And so we're called to envision, I think maybe through a framework of Jubilee, an alternative vision of relationship with one another, with land, with Creator.
So if I didn't make clear, with MHCH, Making Housing and Community Happen, PMC has been involved in almost every campaign that we've done over the years. And so we have four teams. We have our safe parking team. So we started the first safe parking program in the San Gabriel Valley here in Pasadena at Trinity Lutheran Church. And our committee that started that is now pretty close, making good progress at starting a second one in Arcadia. I can't give you a lot of the specifics or the church site it's going to be at because we don't want to alert opposition. We've had a lot of opposition in the neighborhood to our safe parking program here in Pasadena. But that's one thing we're doing. We have our North Fair Oaks team, which is working to revitalize the neighborhood on North Fair Oaks above Washington. And that is spearheaded by about 10 churches in that corridor, 10 mostly African American churches, and by Jason Smith, who is part of our church, is working on that team, and so is Joe Bautista. And Jason Smith is going to be doing a mural up there because we're the revitalization. Yeah, he's going to be doing a mural showing a lot of the. It's going to be a lot of the figures from that neighborhood who are very famous, like Jackie Robinson. Mac Robinson, it's revitalizing that neighborhood through art, complete streets, which makes the streets viable for pedestrians, cyclists, people of all modes of transportation, and affordable housing. And then we have our congregational land team. That's a team of experts. It's actually a partnership with LA Voice. It's a team of experts. They have their own funding, and they consult with congregations to build affordable housing. So they're working with over 40 congregations across Southern California, including one in Pasadena, and I can't tell you which. That's a secret right now. But we are working with the Pasadena church to use their land for affordable housing. And probably it looks like we might have a second one. And that team is also mentoring other teams in other parts of the country. So that's one thing we're doing. And then we have our main, see, safe parking. Yeah, we have our main advocacy team, which is called ASHA, Affordable Supportive Housing Advocates. So that team right now is the biggest campaign. There's several things going on, but the biggest one is to get our school district to use some of its closed school sites for affordable housing. And I've talked about this here before, but in the last 18 years, the Pasadena Unified School District has closed 11 campuses. Now, most school districts in California have been closing campuses, but not 11 in the last 18 years. Pasadena is like way off the charts on this. And that's because the housing prices are so high. During most of those years, Pasadena's population was increasing, but people who send their kids to public schools were moving away. We're being displaced. So we're saying, like, use some of your land for affordable housing. So this church joined in. A lot of you wrote emails on that. The good news, I don't know if I've said this here before. Good news is that on March 28th, the school district did vote to use the old Roosevelt Elementary School site for affordable staff housing. That's and they also talked about using a second site. So we're going to have to, you know, stay on that because these decisions can be reversed. They've talked about using a second site for student family housing. So that's going to be the probably for this congregation the thing we can be involved in. There are other things going on. I'll keep alerting people too, but that's probably the big one that we can be involved in. And I would say it's going to be easily 9 months before we can rest assured that Roosevelt site's actually going to be used for affordable housing. And then we can maybe join in the campaign to get a second site used. But there's also always zoning battles going on. Zoning, if you know the history of zoning, it's racist, it's classist, and it's probably one of the major reasons we have such high housing prices today. Every once in a while, some of you have been around, you know some of our battles have been around zoning. So I will probably bring some of that to our congregation in the future too.
Thank you both for leading us and guiding us in those areas of ministry. I mean, there are other areas that we work on with justice and service and have historically, as you mentioned, political advocacy. We've done that through LA Voice, through Bread for the World, and through any number of organizations that, say, Lori and Una have brought forward. Maybe Una stepped out. But anyway, there have been a lot of great opportunities to lift up our voices and I would say, work in the public square, as Jesus did. So with that, let me just close us in prayer, and we'll move forward into worship. Loving God, thank you for the opportunities to seek justice. Thank you for fellowship and community and solidarity. Please guide our steps and our actions. Please move us forward with your plans, not ours. Help us to recover when we stumble, and to please you and do your will. In your name we pray. Amen.